All right, we're beginning here on Pei Bet Amud Bet by the two dots towards the wider lines there. Mishnah speaks about the position of Rabbi Meir, who we assume is the Tana Kama. And Rabbi Meir's position is that Mavir Chavit Makom Nakom Shavra Ben Shomer Chinam Ben Shomer Sachar Yishava. Then he takes a Shvua. Lememra to Sava Rabbi Meir Nitka Lab Poshehu. From this, you would conclude that Rabbi Meir believes that tripping in of itself is not negligence. This is a machloket that we saw back in the Gemara in Baba Kama. And here, from this Mishnah, it would seem the fact that Rabbi Meir allows you to take a shvua, which is a shvua that was not posheya, that means, by definition, he doesn't consider the fact that you tripped to be a posheya. Vatanya, and here is the opinion of Rabbi Meir that we saw in Baba Kama, nishbira kado v'lo silko. He fell and he broke his barrel or his pitcher, Nafla gmalo v'lo mida, or his gamal fell over and he did not upright it. Rabbi Meir michayev behazekan. Rabbi Meir says that that becomes a bor b'shuta rabim, the fact that you did not clear up the mess that you made. Chamim amrim patur midinei adam b'chayav b'dinei shamayim. That we can't obligate him in terms of a judicial process here, but b'dinei shamayim b'chayav, because he should have cleaned it up. But yet he is not obligated b'kaimelon. And we explain there, the minit ka poshea plige. The machloket is about what we consider a person who trips. Rabbi Meir says a person who trips is a posheya, is negligent, and therefore whatever he leaves on the ground is considered to be a bor b'shuta rabim, because he generated it through pshiya. On the other hand, the chachamim believe that nitkal onesu, that a person who trips is accidental, and you can't create a bor without kavana. And so therefore what you created here is not really a bor b'shuta rabim, and that's why you are patur midinei adam. But what you have now is a stira in Rabbi Meir's position. Rabbi Meir in Baba Kama says, nitkal posheyahu, the person who trips is considered to be negligent. And over here, Rabbi Meir is allowing you to take a shua that you're not negligent when you tripped. So it sounds like nitkal la posheyahu, according to Rabbi Meir, and that's a stira within Rabbi Meir. The truth is that it's not only a stira within Rabbi Meir, it should be a stira within Rabbi Yehuda as well. Because Rabbi Yehuda argues on Rabbi Meir, both here, and in the Gemara in Baba Kama, the Chachamim, or the Tana Kama in Baba Kama, we establish as Rabbi Yehuda. So that means that you have Rabbi Yehuda's position also be problematic, or a stira, which the Gemara doesn't ask. But Tosafot raises that. He says, Ava Rabbi Yehuda, the Rabbi Yehuda, lo kasha. That's not a problem, because Rabbi Yehuda's position is an in-between position. The Sava Rabbi Yehuda, nitka la poshehu. That's right. Rabbi Yehuda does believe that a nitkal is not considered to be negligent. But came into lavi posheya. Since he's not a posheya, Afagav de lo havianus gamur. Patur, benishbra kado, velo suka, de lo chashibor el shnaseb bipshia. So Tosafot says is that tripping sits somewhere in between. He's not a posheya, but he's also not an anus gamur. He's not completely exempt and it's a complete mistake or accident, but it's also not complete negligence. It sits somewhere between the two, which Tosafot calls gneva vaveda. Gneva and aveda are not complete onsin, but they're also not complete pshia. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda's shita can be reconciled. Rabbi Yehuda over there believes you can only create a bor if you're a posheya, if negligent. Tripping is not negligence. So therefore, you can't create or establish a bor b'shuta rabim when you trip. Over here, he says that the shavu'ah that you're going to take is for a problem of gneva v'aveda. Gneva v'aveda is not pshia, is not negligence, but it's also not ones. But he's somewhere in between. And that's exactly what he's taking a shvua for over here. And this is Tosafot l'shitato, because Tosafot l'shitato goes on to explain with regards to Adama Mazik, which he asks about here. Even if you don't consider the person to be a posheya like Rabbi Meir, even according to Rabbi Yehuda, why isn't he just deemed an Adama Mazik? And Adama Mazik is chayav in everything. Onsin, no matter what he does, he's chayav. So here, Tosafot l'shitato, he has the same shita that he brings in Baba Kama, is that Adam HaMazik, even though we say that in general, Adam HaMazik is chayav no matter what, it's not no matter what. If it's an ones gamur, it's a complete ones, then he is not chayav as an Adam HaMazik. And then he goes on to make a finer distinction, which is ones that is geneva is considered to be patur for Adam HaMazik. Ones that's considered to be aveda is chayav Adam HaMazik. So what he says is that when you say Adama Mazik is Chayav, that's for everything except Onis Gamur, anything besides a full-fledged accident. Besides that, even within the spectrum of negligence all the way to an accident, you have along that way, you have a spectrum of items. Gneva is something that is onus. It is somewhat out of your control, unforeseen, but you are somewhat responsible because you didn't take the right precautions, the right protections. But that's something that's karov the onus, as he calls it. Whereas aveda, when you lose something, that's karov the pshia, because that's something that you caused or something that is your own fault in a sense, even though it's unintentional, it's still your own fault. And he says along that spectrum, anything that is from Gneva all the way to Onis Gamur is patur even by Adama Mazik. Anything that's from Aveda up to Pshia is Chayav by Adama Mazik. And that's how Tosafot deals with these issues over here. Number one, explaining that Rabbi Yehuda's position with regards to Nitkal is somewhere between Posheya and Onis. And number two is, he explains that Adama Mazik is not relevant when you're talking about either Onis Gamur or even Gneva, which is Karov, the Onis. Adama Mazik is not Chayav in that case, and that's why we're not Mechayev you here as Adama Mazik. The Ramban, as we saw in Baba Kama, argues against this Balei HaTosafot and says that you are Chayav across the board. Adama Mazik, when we say is Chayav even on his Gamur. Over here, we have to explain that the status of these individuals is not Adama Mazik, but rather a Shomer. He's acting and functioning like a Shomer. He has no intent to damage the item. He is not involved in a process that might lead to damaging, even accidental damaging. He is a shomer. And as a shomer, he has certain rules, and those rules will be applied. He won't have the application of Adama Mazik. But that machloket has implications over here, as that explained the Gemara. So now we have two answers that are going to be offered in to reconcile this stira within Rabbi Meir. The first one is, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Tavra, Misha Shanazo, Lo Shanazo. That we have two authors of Rabbi Meir's position. The Mishnayot cannot be reconciled, which is, the Mishnah here is clearly says that Rabbi Meir believes Nitzkal Anusu, whereas the Mishnah over there, the Braita in Baba Kama, believes that Rabbi Meir believes Nitzkal Pusheyahu, and we can't reconcile them. And that's what the terminology Tavra usually means. Tavra means we have an irreconcilable position, and therefore you have to break it. Break it means that you have to say that it has dual authorship, that it's not the same author or the same position that is bringing them down. Va'ata Rabbi Yehuda l'meimar. Rabbi Yehuda comes to say, Shomer Chinam Yishava, Nosei Sachar Yishalem. So Rabbi Yehuda says that a Shomer Chinam will take a Shvua, because a Shomer Chinam is Patur from Gneva ve'Aveda. He doesn't classify it as a Pshia, as Balei Tosafot already noted, but he also doesn't classify it as an Onis Gamor. He classifies it as Gneva ve'Aveda. If you do that, then a Shomer Chinam can take a Shvua and dismiss his liabilities. Nosei Sachar Yishalem. But a Shomer Sachar will have to pay for Gneva ve'Aveda. Over here, he might be a Nosei Sachar instead of a Shomer Sachar, because he's not necessarily getting paid. It might be some sort of Hana'ah or consideration that he's getting that makes him into a Nosei Sachar, but not necessarily a paid Shomer Sachar. Ha'iki dinei v'ha'iki dinei. Rabbi Yehuda says that's the din of a Shomer Chinam and a din of a Shomer Sachar. Va'ata Rabbi Eliezer le'meimar. That's a little difficult. We have in our Mishnah, as well as over here in the Gemara, it's Rabbi Eliezer, although that's very difficult, because that would make him Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkunus. And Rabbi Eliezer ben Hurkunus is older, in an older generation, than Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. And so it wouldn't make so much sense that Rabbi Eliezer was addressing Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir. Therefore, you could see in the Masorah Tashas by the Mishnah, that he says it's likely Rabbi Elazar, Stam Rabbi Elazar and Shas, who is Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. That would make more sense because he is a peer with Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir, and therefore his appearance in the Mishnah would not be so surprising. And therefore it's all likelihood the Girsa should be here Rabbi Elazar and not Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi Elazar says in our Mishnah, in Gemara ki Rabbi Meir, the Mesorah is like Rabbi Meir. I have the same Mesorah that Rabbi Meir says, which is both the Shomer Sachar and the Shomer Chinam take a Shvua Shlo Pashu. He says, Miu Tzmi'ani, Im Yecholim Zev Ezeli Shava. He says, but I don't understand it. I don't know how both of them can take a Shvua. Bishlomo Shomer Chinam Mishtaba Delo Pashaba. Shomer Chinam can take a Shvua that he wasn't Posheya. If he says he's not Posheya, then he's Patur from anything else, because that's the only thing that a Shomer Chinam is Chayav for. El Shomer Sechar Amai Mishtaba. Why does the Shomer Sechar take a Shvua? Kilo Pasha Nami Shlume Bai. Even if he is not Posheya, he's still liable for the Gneva and Aveda aspects of it. Even a Shomer Chinam, Atinach b'makom midron. That makes sense when it was on an area that was inclined or had a decline. Then you can make a claim that it was not a Posheya when he tripped, because there's some other factor that is contributing to the fact that he fell or the item dropped. Shalom b'makom midron, but in a flat surface, Mi matzi mishtaba de lo pasha? How can he really take a shua that he wasn't poshe, he wasn't negligent? It's a flat surface. It is an area where you would not expect him to fall, and yet he fell and he destroyed whatever item he was carrying. Vafilu b'makom midrom, nami. Even in a location where it's inclined or declined, where you would consider him possibly not to be a posheya, hatinachecha daleke raya. That's true when there is no proof. If there is proof, then he should have to bring the proof. Then he'll be able to exempt himself. The Tanya, Isi ben Yehuda omer, ein ro'eh shvat Hashem tiyeh ben shnehem. Since there was no witness to the event, the only thing that we can utilize in order to adjudicate the case is a shvua. If we have no witnesses, then the only one who can be the witness is Hashem. Hashem is the sole witness to what happened, and therefore the shvua becomes the vehicle for adjudicating between the parties. Hayesh ro'eh, but that means if there are people who saw it or witnessed it, yavi ra'yavi pater, he has to bring proof, he has to bring those witnesses to exempt himself. Over here you have two views within the Geonim Rishonim as to Isi ben Yehuda's din. The Bahag suggests that Isi ben Yehuda's din is a hakala, a leniency on the individual, which basically offers him the choice as to whether to take the Shvua or to bring a din. And that's what Isi ben Yehuda is suggesting, that you can either bring a din when there are a din, or you can take a Shvua in order to exempt yourself. But it's a hakala, it's a leniency on this individual that he can opt out of the shvua by bringing a dim, and that will solve his problem. Whereas the majority of Rishonim, the Rif, brings that opinion and then rejects it. And the majority of the Rishonim follow that position of the Rif, which is, this is an obligation on the individual, and he has no choice but to bring a dim. Once there are a dim to the fact, a shvua is no longer a vehicle for exempting himself from liability. Once there are edim, we're going to demand that he bring edim. And if he doesn't bring the edim, that's already considered to be a riuta, cast aspersions on his claim, because there were edim and he can't bring them forward to testify on his behalf. The fact that he can't bring edim already weakens his position, and therefore he can't take a shvua anymore. And Isi ben Yehuda would demand that there is no shvua. So what the Gemara just did here was narrow the scope of where we would say that the Shomer Chinam would take a shvua, saying that he wasn't a posheya. It would have to be an instance where it really was an ones, it wasn't a posheya. One would be where there's no witnesses, because if there are witnesses, he wouldn't be able to take a shvua. And even in the case where he's just simply carrying it, it's not automatic that he's nitzkal lav posheyahu. It has to be a situation in which there are other contributing factors that would make an ones. For instance, the incline, decline, something that would contribute to his tripping, rather than simply being a flat surface where he's moving from one place to the other where he shouldn't have tripped in that location. So that's the first answer, which is we uphold Rabbi Meir's position here that he is nitkal lab posheyahu, and nitkal is considered to be an ones, or according to Balei Tosfot, equivalent of gneva va'aveda, but just closer to the side of ones. And back in Baba Kama, Rabbi Meir's position was nitkal posheyahu, and Rabbi Meir's position is being stated by different authors, and that's why we have this difference. The other alternative is Rabbi Chiya Bava Amar Rabbi Yochanan. He offers us a second answer, which is Shvua Zo Takanat Chachamim. This Shvua over here is a Takanat Chachamim, meaning Meikar Adin, you shouldn't be able to take this Shvua and exempt yourself, because you are a Posheya when you trip. And so if you're a Posheya when you trip, like Rabbi Meir Shita and Baba Kama, then no Shvua is going to help you out. Both the Shomer Chinam and the Shomer Sechar should be Chayavim. Now that is somewhat of a machloket here as to whether Rabbi Chiya Ba'abo is coming to address the position of Rabbi Meir or the position of Rabbi Yehuda. Meaning that the way I explained it is that he's addressing both Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, and therefore even by a Shomer Chinam, he's saying that this Shvua was instituted. Whereas if you think he's speaking within the position of Rabbi Yehuda, then all he's telling you is why the Shomer Sechar is given the right of a Shvua over here, whereas a Shomer Chinam would not have that benefit, because a Shomer Chinam just has to take a Shvua that he wasn't a Posheya. She'im iyatal mer kein, because if you don't say this, ein lecha adam avir chavid lechavirov mimakom lemakom. Nobody is going to transfer or transport these items for someone, because as soon as something happens, accidentally they trip, and then they're going to be responsible for the item. Nobody's going to undertake that type of work. So, heche mishtaba. Well, if you're telling me now that he is classified as a posheya, but yet he's allowed to take a shvua, what exactly is the shvua that he's taking? He's saying, I'm not a posheya, but he was a posheya because he tripped. And when he tripped, as a posheya, that's the only shvua that we would require from a shomer. So then what shvua are you asking him to make? So Amarava, shvua, shalobi kavana, shivartia. That I did not break it intentionally. So all we wanted to do is acknowledge that he didn't break it intentionally. Once he hasn't broken it intentionally, it might be through his negligence that he tripped. And that's what caused the damage. But that we give him an exemption for in order to facilitate people interacting with each other and working together. Otherwise, nobody's going to work together. And Rabbi Yehuda rejects Rabbi Meir's position and says, no, that a shomer chinam takes a shvua, nosei sachar pays, ha'kidinei va'ha'kidinei, each one of them according to their din. This is Rabbi Yehuda the shitato, the nitkal is an usu. But as we said before, that's not literally an ones, it's more like a geneva and a veda setup. Va'ata Rabbi Elazar lemeimar in, gemara ki Rabbi Meir, the mesora is like Rabbi Meir, that they both take a shvua. Miut mia ani im yecholim zev zeli shava. Says, I just don't understand why both of them could take a shvua. Bishlama shomer chinam ishtabash lo pashaba. Shomer chinam could take a shvua that he was not negligent with it. El shomer sachar ama ishtabah, ki lo pashan, nami bai lishlume. Why would he take a shvua that exempts him because he wasn't negligent? Even if he wasn't negligent, he still has to pay. Vafilu shomer chinam nami, even the shomer chinam hati nachu makom midron. That makes sense that he can say I wasn't a posheya when it was an area that had a slope to it. Shalom makom midron, place that doesn't have a slope, mi matzi mishtaba, shalom pasha. Can he really say that he wasn't negligent tripping on a flat surface? Bafilu makom midron, nami. Even in the place where there's a slope, hatinach hecha deleke raya. That's only if there's no evidence or outside evidence. Hecha deika raya. In a case where there are witnesses to the event, neite raya mi pater. Then he should have to bring them. Why should he be able to use a shvua? To exempt himself, he should have to bring the edim, the witnesses to the fact. The Tani, Yisra ben Yehuda omer, Ein roeh shvuat Hashem tiyeh ben shnehem, that if there was no witness to the event, then the shvua becomes the vehicle for levarer, to clarify the situation. Hayesh roeh, but if we have witnesses, yavi rayavi pater, then he should have to bring the witnesses in order to clarify the situation or the case. Alright, so there we have two answers, how to reconcile with Rabbi Meir. One answer is, we can't reconcile, it's irreconcilable, it's Tavra, Misha Shanazul, Lo Shanazul. Rabbi Meir here, and Rabbi Meir and Baba Kama cannot be reconciled. The second answer is that, no, Rabbi Meir is Lashitato, that Nitkal is Pusheya, but this is a unique circumstance where Chazal instituted the ability to take a Shvua and exempt yourself. Obviously not a Shvua that you're not negligent, because you are negligent by mere fact that you tripped. So the Shvua you have to take is that you do not intentionally damage it. Once you do that, Chazal allowed you to be exempt, so facilitate the ability of people to interact and carry things for other people. There was this individual who was transporting barrels, pitchers of wine, in the main thoroughfares of Mechuza. And then he smashed it on a something that protruded, some sort of board or something that protruded into the Rishut HaRabim. Ata the Kamei Darabah. He came to Rava to figure out whether he has to pay the individual for whom he was transporting these wine barrels. Amalei Riskata de Mechuza Shchichi Bayinche says Riskata Mechuza is a main thoroughfare, and there are definitely people who witnessed the event. Zil Aiti Raya Biftar. Go ahead and bring proof that you should be patur in this instance. Meaning the Groza Gross says that the Girsa de Grif in the Rosh is the Lo Pashataba. That you weren't a posheya. So assuming that this individual was a shomer chinam, and therefore if he wasn't a posheya, it'd be fine. But here he has to bring evidence to the fact that he's not a posheya. This is the rif l'shitato, that once you have witnesses, you can't get out of being a posheya, elim ken you bring the witnesses. A shvua will not suffice anymore. And so therefore you have to bring witnesses to substantiate your claim that you're not negligent, and then you will be patur in this instance. So amalei Rav Yosef Bray. So Rabbi Yosef, Rabbo's son, says to him, come on, who is this like? Ki Isi? Are you now concluding the case and saying that this has the din like Isi ben Yehuda, who says that once there are witnesses, you can't take a shvua anymore, but rather you must bring the witnesses? Amalei in ki Isi, that's right. Rabbo says, I am paskening like Isi, v'svira lan kavate. And that is aloha. The aloha is like Isi, and that's why I'm adjudicating the case in that manner and saying that he has to bring witnesses, otherwise he cannot exempt himself from being a posheya, being negligent in this case. How gavro, damale de chavre, zil zamen li arba mea dani de chamra. He says, go purchase for me 400 barrels of wine. Azal Zabanay, he went ahead and purchased it for him. The Sof Ata the Kamei, then eventually he comes there and says, Amarle Zvina Lachar Ba Mea Dani Chamra, at your behest, I purchased those 400 barrels of wine for you. But they all went bad, and they're all vinegar now. So once again, they came before Rava. He says, 400 barrels of wine that go bad and turn into vinegar, that is something that is well known, or it would be in the public sphere. Says, go ahead and bring proof or evidence to the fact that when you bought them originally, they were wine, and only after the fact did they turn into vinegar. So Rava's chashash here is that either he just purchased vinegar up front, took the money for wine, purchased vinegar, and then said it all turned into vinegar, or he gave him his own wine, which he knew was turning into vinegar, and he sold it to him, and then it turned into vinegar. But he knew up front that there was a problem with whatever he purchased. The reason being, either because if someone else's wine had turned into vinegar, then that would be something that is unusual. That is a huge loss. That is not something that a person would sustain a loss like that and not speak about it or not tell other people about it because it's so significant and it's so unusual for something like that to happen. So since that would be something that would be otherwise known, then the fact that we have no information or nobody's telling us or corroborating that evidence, that's so much suspicious to us that this happened. Or the other way around is if his barrels went bad or the stuff that he had purchased for him went bad, he would have obviously told someone else about it because it's so unusual an event that he wouldn't have just kept this private, oh, I bought these 400 barrels of wine for so-and-so. And he can't believe they turned into vinegar. The fact that he didn't disclose that information to anyone seems unbelievable. And so therefore he says, bring me proof that you have outside evidence or that we have confirmation of the fact that it turned into vinegar and it wasn't vinegar from the outset, which is the main issue. So I'm Rabbi Yosef Bray, come on. Kisi. Again, you're doing this. This is a psak halacha like Kisi, similar to the previous conversation, that when there is outside evidence, you can't take a shvua anymore. I'm laying in Kisi, Bisviralan Kabate. Yes, once again, it is like Kisi, and we paskin like him. Now, why did the Gemara bring the two cases? It's because this case is different than the first case. In the first case, he was talking about real edim, that there were witnesses to the event, and that's exactly like Kisi. Rava over here brings the second case, where he paskins like Isi, but not when there are real witnesses to the event, but rather he's saying that there should have been information that was out in the public sphere. We're not talking about there was somebody watching it turn into vinegar. We're talking about the fact that that information should have been known to the public. So we're not talking about Edim that witnessed the event, but rather Edim that have information that would help us in the case. And Rava says in that case as well, the din of Isi is applicable. You have to bring the evidence, and you can't use a shvua to get out of the problem. Itkin Rav Chiya bar Yosef b'Sichra. Rav Chiya bar Yosef instituted in Sichra, the name of a location, a city in Bavel that was along the Tigris River. Hani the Daru ba'Agra v'Itvar. These people that we call them schleppers, haulers, that take things ba'Agra, we'll explain in 1 second, v'Itvar, and then it breaks, and therefore the merchandise or the item there that he was carrying broke. Nishalein Palgo. They're responsible for half of the loss. My time, what's the reason? Nofish lechad, the load that they're carrying is in excess of what one person can carry. Bezutar the tray. On the other hand, it's too little to put two people on the job. So karav l'ones, v'karav l'pshia. He sits somewhere between ones and pshia. It's not a pusheya because two people wouldn't do it. But it's not an ones because it's a little bit much for one person. So since he sits in that middle ground, we make him responsible for half of the losses. So now Rashi over here explains what this agra is. He says, mot kafuf bemtzo. It is a rod that is bent in the middle. Notno al ktefo. And he puts it on his shoulder. Venoseh shnei badim b'shnei rashim. And he puts weight or parcels on both ends of the stick. Venoseh bo maseh kaved. And he takes with it a heavy load. Like what we would think of a water carrier who has a long rod or piece of wood and he has the two barrels of water or buckets of water on either side. And then he carries it across his shoulders on his neck. So he's carrying the item in that manner. So again, a person's able to haul much more than his weight given the structure and the balance of the item. But again, it's a little bit much for one person, but too little for two people. And therefore, we make him responsible for half of the losses. Bedigla, mishalayim kula. On the other hand, a person who uses a digla has to pay for the whole amount. So if you look in Rashi, the daru bedigla, this was another mechanism for carrying. It says, eitz mifutzal birosho. It's a piece of wood or a stick that is broken or split at its head. V'kosher bo masash shnei bnei adam. And then he puts on it the load that two people would carry. Umachnit savaro ben shnei p'tzalav. And he puts in his head between the, this is more like a yoke or the equivalent of like a wishbone or a fork where you put it across the neck and then you're able to hold it right in front of you and you're holding it tighter to the body. The agra was further away from the body. This is closer into the body, but it takes much more weight. And as Rashi notes over here, the fact that it takes the more weight, it's the equivalent of what two people would carry. In that case, he's much closer to being a posheya because he took too much weight. And the fact that he overloaded himself, or this mechanism allows you to overload yourself, makes you much more responsible or a posheya, and therefore if it breaks and it falls, he overloaded it. And if he overloaded it, then he's going to be responsible for the whole amount, not just the half amount. Rabba bar Chana, Tavrule Hanushakulai Chavita de Chamra. Abba bar Chana had an incident in which these haulers or schleppers broke his barrel of wine. Shakal Glimahu. He confiscated their cloaks. Now, here is a lot of controversy about why he confiscated their cloaks. Rashi says, Vitabrule Shaloba Makom Midron. It was a case where they broke it where it wasn't sloped, upshia, and they were negligent. So he confiscated their cloaks because they were negligent. If they're negligent, then they are responsible for the payment. And so that's why he confiscated their cloaks in order to get his payment. On the other hand, the Ramban and others suggest that the reason that he confiscated was not for payment, because he doesn't have a right to execute vigilante justice over here and confiscate their items, but rather he wanted to compel them to come to court. So he took their cloaks in order to force them to come to court and adjudicate the case in front of the court. So not that he was taking it for payment, but rather he was simply taking it in order to force them to come to court or to deal with the issue. Atu amru l'rav. So these haulers went and told Rav the story. Amalei havlahu glimayu. He says back to Rabba bar Chana, give them back their cloaks. Amalei dina hochi. He says, is that the right outcome of the case over here? Amalei in. Yes, that is the right outcome. Because it says, aman teleich b'derech tovim. Says that you have to do the right thing. You have to walk the path of those that are good. Rashi says, lifnim mishurat adin. It's not the din, but rather lifnim mishurat adin. I'll come back and address that. So yavlahu glimayu. He handed them back their cloaks. Amalei aniye anan. They said, we are impoverished. We are poor people. Tarchinan kuloyoma. And we worked the whole day on transporting your items. So now you want to say, all right, he can't take our cloak, but he also didn't pay us anything because we broke his barrel, and therefore we lost our salary from him. And therefore we're starving now because we have nothing to show for our work, and we have nothing to our name. Rav says to Rabbi Bar Chana, go pay their salaries now. He says, is that the proper outcome or the just manner of this case? He says, once again, yes. Varchot tzadikim tishmor. It's the end of the pasuk. That the ways of the tzadikim should be guarded. Meaning again, he's saying to him that you have to act in a proper manner here. And even though the way Rashi phrases it is, even though it's not an obligation, but lifnim mishurat adin would demand that in this case you act properly with these individuals. That number one, their tripping or breaking of your barrel was accidental. And number two is, you should pay them because they're impoverished, and even though they broke something, it was unintentional, and you should at least give them their salary so that they can feed themselves and take care of themselves. So that's the way Rashi explains it. The Baal HaTosafot back on Chov Dalet Amud Bet also explained it as being Lifnim Mishurat Adin. There the Baal HaTosafot brought three different levels of Lifnim Mishurat Adin, and Tosafot claimed over there that the Man Derech B'Terech Tovim is the source for a case where even though lifnim mishurat adin costs you money, that you still are obligated to pay for it. And so that's what the man de derech tovim comes to tell you, that lifnim mishurat adin has application, even though you have losses that are sustained by doing lifnei mishurat hadin. Like in this case, where Rabbi Bar Bachana is sustaining losses in order to act with lifnei mishurat hadin. So that's the Balei HaTosafot. But you could argue over here, Rav's response to Rabbi Bar Chana is not that it's lifnei mishurat hadin. He says to him, Dina Hochi, is the din this way? And he says, in, yes, this is the just, this is the right way to adjudicate this case. Implying that this was me'ikar adin and not lifnei mishurat adin. That's what it sounds like from his statement. Now, of course, that's hard, because why should he be chayav in this case when they are causing or he's sustaining losses because of their work? So what some suggest is that for a Talmud Chacham, or a person of stature, their lifnei mishurat adin becomes an obligation. Now this reminds me, there is a shloh in the beginning of Parshat Kedoshim. In the beginning of Parshat Kedoshim, there's a famous Ramban who says that Kedoshim is that you can't be a Naval B'shut Torah, but rather, you have to be Mekadesh Atzmecha B'mutar Lach. That you have to sanctify yourself with things that are mutar, things that are completely okay according to the Torah. Nevertheless, a person has to take precautions, but also elevate themselves to the point where they don't just act like some Naval, lowlife, with the permission of the Torah, that they're getting drunk and that they are gluttonous, all those things. So the Shlah over there takes that statement of the Ramban one step further and claims that the Kedoshim to you is a way for the Torah to deal with the fact that we're all different. The Torah gives us a baseline of halakha. The baseline of halakha is the lowest common denominator between all peoples. Because if the Torah is going to be for everyone, it has to give you an objective standard that everyone can uphold. But then, people are different. And each person can do things that maybe exceed the basic objective standard that's there. What the Shlach suggests is that we have a subjective requirement, midoraita, to act b'kedoshim to you, to sanctify ourselves, or in a sense, be lifnei mishurat hadin, depending on who we are. And our stature and our persona will determine what the halacha is on a subjective basis for us, and not just that objective baseline standard. So if you take that shlaw and you apply it over here, that might be what Rav is saying to Rabbi Bar Bachana, which is, you're right, when we talk about the ikar adin, or the letter of the law, over here you're not chayav. But a person of your stature, a person of your means, should be able to deal in this case by taking care of these individuals, not being punitive towards them and taking their cloaks, and as well as paying them even though they caused you losses, because that is the right thing to do over here. And since it's the right thing to do over here, as the Ramban says, "Be'avsita yashar v'atov," that there is a requirement to do what is right and just, meaning that even though the Torah can encapsulate everything that needs to be done, it has a requirement or an overarching theme of "Be'avsita yashar v'atov." And that might be what Rav is indicating to Rabbi Bar Chana, that you have a personal obligation over here, even though it may not be the letter of the law. You, as Rabbi Bar Chana, this is your letter of the law because of who you are. And therefore it is the din to do this and not necessarily lifnim mishurat hadin. Okay, with that we end the parak of Asucher Ta'umanim. Hadron Alach, Asucher Ta'umanim. Okay, now we begin Asucher Ta'poalim. You remember from the beginning of the previous parak that the Balei HaTosafot indicated to us that Umanim can refer to both Kablanim and Poalim. It's a generic term that refers to any type of worker, whether you are a contracted employee or a day laborer. On the other hand, the word poalim means specifically a poel, is a day worker or a day laborer. And therefore, when the Mishnah says over here, socher et poalim, it means literally a socher et poalim. V'amar lehem lashkim ul'ariv. So when he hired these workers, he told them to come early to work and to stay late at work. So as the Balei HaTosafot point out over here, when he hired them, he made no stipulations. If he made the stipulations at the time of hiring them, they can make whatever conditions they want in their agreement, and they'd have to abide by those conditions. The fact is here, he did not stipulate any conditions, he just hired them. Then, after they show up on the job, he tells them, I want you coming early, and I want you leaving late. The Mishnah says, Makom shnagu shelo lashkim v'shelo lariv. If it's a place where the normal working hours of these individuals is not to come early and not to stay late, einu rashai lekufan. He has no right to compel them or obligate them to do so. He did not stipulate this up front. This is not the practice in this area, and therefore he has no right to say such a thing. Makom shenagula zon izon. In a place where you feed the workers, he's obligated to feed the workers. The sapek mimitika isapek. If it's a place where you can either call this dessert, they provide dessert, Or more likely the way Rashi calls it is liftan, which is something to accompany the bread. There's some sort of condiment or dip or something that, that would enhance the meal or the bread, then he has to provide that as well. Hakol k'minhag ha'midina. All of it is dependent on the practices of the locale. Meaning that when you hire on a default basis and you do not stipulate any specific conditions of your agreement, then you're subject to the rules of that area. And whatever the practices are, you're subject to those practices. Maaseh b'Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthew, if you remember, we saw this earlier in the Masechta, back on Daf Mamtet, that Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthew sent his son, Shamar libno tzeis cholanu po'alim, go and hire for us workers. Halachu pasak lehem mizonot. He went ahead and he hired them and said that they'll provide meals. Shabbai tel aviv amar lo b'ni. Afilu mata oseh lehem k'sudat shlomo b'shato lo yatzat yedei chovatcha imahem. Even if you make them a meal like Shlomo HaMelech, which was a grandiose meal at the time of the consecration of the Mikdash, Shehem b'nei Abraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov. They are the children of Abraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov. The Gemara later on will explain to us that which Abraham served to the Malachim was even more festive and expensive than that which Shlomo HaMelech had provided. And if these are the children of Abraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, then you would have to provide meals for them that far exceed our capabilities or abilities over here. El Achol Yetchilu b'Malacha. Before they start working, say v'amor them. Go back and tell them, Almanat shein lachem alai elapat v'kitnit. That the meal that we're going to serve you is bread and legumes, and that's it. Bilvad. Nothing more than that. That's all you're going to get. I mean that you have to stipulate what the size of the meal is. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel omer, lo yatzarich lomar, hakol k'minhag ha'midina. Shimon Gamliel points out that there's no reason for him to do that because the assumption is that whatever the default status in this locale is, that's when he provided them his own notes. He's going to provide them meals that are the meals of this area. Obviously, Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthew was worried because his son promised them his own notes. His own notes were automatically a part of the package that you would have gotten if he stipulated nothing. So when he goes in and then asks them, tells them he's going to give them his own note, sounds like he's going to give them something in excess of what is the norm here. And the problem is he doesn't have any guidelines as to what it is. And based on the fact that these are the children of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, then he might have promised something that he cannot fulfill. Therefore, he tells him to go back and tell them that this is the meal that you're going to get. He has to specify or stipulate the meal. Now, the reason that he had to do this before they started working, according to Rashi, is because the ain kan ela dvarim. Before they start working, it's just a oral commitment. The dvarim ain behem mishum mechusarei amana. And Rashi claims, based on the Gemara that we saw back on Memtet, that an oral commitment, a verbal commitment, is not binding. Because you can walk away from that, and there are no implications from walking away from that. A person doesn't have to stand by their word. That's what Rashi says. You look in the Bach, the Oth Bet in the Bach, says, I don't understand. The Gemara there concluded just the opposite. That Dvarim Yesh Lehem Mishum Chusei Amana. When you make a claim and you make a statement, you have to stand by that statement. Okay, you may not be subject to Mishapara, but you still have to stand by it. And the Chachamim looked negatively upon someone who breaks their word or doesn't keep their word. And the Bach says, that's not what the Gemara says over there. If you remember, the Gemara over there says, the reason he was able to back out of it is because the workers knew that he was the son of the Baal HaBayit. And they knew that he had to go check with his father before the deal was sealed. And therefore, they assumed, until he spoke to his father, the deal was not complete. And they waited to hear back that their father approved of it. So therefore, when he comes back and he changes the terms, they knew that that was a possibility, and therefore they did not consider it to be a sealed deal or a complete deal, and that's why he was able to back out of it. Okay, now the Gemara says, Pshita, what's the question over here? In terms of the Po'alim, he's asking now to get up early and to stay late. What right does he have to do that? Meaning that, why does he have this right all of a sudden to make demands on them when he hired them, and he's paying them the normal rates, and they have to work the normal hours? Why does he get anything in excess of that? Mar says, Lotzricha datafi luhu agrayu. He gave them extra pay. He paid them above market. And he says, Madute mamar luhu. He says to them, Hada dafai luhu agrayu adaita demaktimitu umakshechitu baadai. Says, the reason I paid you in excess of market is because I expected you to get up early with me and stay late with me to work excess hours for the excess pay that you're getting. Kamash malon, damrulei, they can say to him, Hada tafat lan. The reason that you gave us a higher pay than market is, if we do for you a better job. Qualitatively, we're going to do better work for you because you paid us more. So since nothing was stipulated in the payment of above market, The Baal HaBayit makes an assumption, and the workers make an assumption. The Baal HaBayit makes an assumption you're going to work longer hours because I paid you more. The Baalim say, no, we're going to do a qualitative better job, and that's why you paid us more. Since there was no stipulation, and there was no articulation of why he's paying them more, it goes with Minhag HaMedina. Minhag HaMedina is that they don't have to work the longer hours, and therefore he doesn't have a right to demand for them the long hours, despite the fact that he paid them more, or in excess of market. Amar Reish Lakish. So Reish Lakish says, Poel b'knisato mishelo u'b'yitziato mishel Baal HaBayit. That at Poel, now the way Rashi and the Baalei HaTosafot explain it over here, knisato means his way home. It's in the opposite order. You would have thought that the Gemara is first speaking about on his way to work and then the way back from work. That's the way the Rabbeinu Chananel explains it. But the Rashi and the Tosafot over here explain that Poel b'knisato means on his way home, mishelo, it's on his own cheshbon. Meaning that he has to finish out the hours of the day, and then he walks home. When he goes home, that's on his cheshbon, meaning that it's after he's finished the work for the Baal HaBayit. He goes home because that's for himself. When he wants to go home and he wants to go eat and be comfortable in his house, that's in his cheshbon. B'yitziato, on the other hand, on his way to work, his commute to work, Michel Baal HaBayit. He does that on the Baal HaBayit's clock. So that he doesn't have to start working exactly when the workday starts. Rather, he has to start traveling. He has to start out for work at the time that the workday starts. So that's the distinction that the Baalei HaTosafot and both Rashi make over here. Tosafot over here discusses whether this makes sense. Is the word knisah and yitziah used in this way? Does the Midrash halacha support this? And Tosafot goes through proving that that is the case. He quotes from the Rabbeinu Chananel that the Rabbeinu Chananel learned just the opposite, which is perush b'knisato l'melachto. When he goes out to work, notem mishalo the Baal HaBayit. Umameher, let's say, kodem netzachama. That he has to leave early, the commute is on him. On the way out, the commute is on him. Whereas on the way back from the Baal HaBayit, he can leave before the workday's over in order to get home at dark. And therefore he's able to do that in the cheshbon of Baal HaBayit. That is the way the Rabbeinu Chananel learns it. Again, the exact opposite of the way that Rashi and Tosafot learn over here. The problem is, then what is the chiddush of Reish Lakish in that case? Meaning that, according to the Baalei HaTosafot and Rashi, the chiddush is where the individual has to give up time. On the other hand, according to Rabbeinu Chananel, he wants to bring it back to bring a posuk that seemingly supports what the explanation of Rashi and Tosafot is. The Rabbeinu Chananel has to suggest that Reish Lakish's chiddush is that he went against what was the Torah's prescription based on the posuk. And that's the chiddush over here, which is very strange, given the fact that the Gemara is about to say, let's look at how they practiced. Why should you look at how they practiced or what the minhag was? According to Rabbeinu Chananel, the whole chiddush of Reish Lakish is that he's going against the minhag. And he's saying that this is the din against the minhag. So that's why Tosafot rejects Rabbeinu Chananel's explanation. The Gemara says, Shenemar, Reish Lakish brings a proof to his statement. Again, we're going to bring the second half of the pasuk in a second. But as Rashi notes over here, this is from Bar Chinafshi. So you're familiar with it because of saying it on Rosh Chodesh, which is the pasuk before it says, Tashet choshech v'ilayla, bo tirmos ko chotel yar, the animals go out at night, and they wander around, or they stir at night through the forest, and then the pasuk continues now, Tizrach ha-shemesh ye'asefun, when the sun rises, that's when they begin to gather. Ve'el me'onotam yirbatsun. Into their plans, they crouch or they get readied. Yetze adam lefa'alo. A person goes out to do his work. Ulavaroto adei erev. And then he persists in his job until nightfall. So from here, the Gemara wants to prove that tezracha shemesh yasefun. When the sun rises, that's when they begin to gather. So they only set out to go to work once the sun has risen. So the workday begins at sunrise, and the workday ends at Seto Kochavim at dark. So what the pasuk seems to indicate is that, Ye'asefun, they only start to gather at sunrise. It's not a requirement to gather at Alot HaShachar in order to start working at sunrise, but rather they gather after the night is gone. They gather together at sunrise in order to set out to their work. So that's Yitze Adam Lepa'olo. That's when a person goes out to work. So that's on Cheshbon Baal HaBayit. Because you go to work after sunrise when the workday has come about. That's because he's walking to you to do your work. Therefore, it's on your Cheshbon. On the other hand, on the way home, Yitzei Adam lefalo, he goes out to work at sunrise, but Abadola de Arev, he stays at work all the way until night. Night meaning Tzeita Kochavim. So at Tzeita Kochavim, he finishes his work, and only then does he set out to go home. So that's on his cheshbon on the way home, because he's doing it for his own benefit. He's now going home, he's not coming for your benefit. And that is this skew in the workday that Rish Lakish describes, which is that the commute begins at sunrise, but your commute home only begins at Tzeita Kochavim. So therefore, in the morning, it's on the Balabait's cheshbon, and at night, it is on the cheshbon of the individual, the poel, the worker. Some suggest, the Beit Balia Tosafot, suggest that the reason being that if we make him set out at dawn, he won't have time to daven. That if he sets out at sunrise, then he can daven between Alot HaShachar and sunrise, only leave for work at sunrise, because then he has a window of opportunity to daven. Even though we know that one should only daven Shmono Esrei, at least after sunrise, nevertheless, a poel, a worker, has permission to daven even the chatchila mealot hashachar. So if you have work to do or you have a work day ahead of you, then one can daven even before sunrise if necessary. But over here, we don't allow him, forced to leave it alot hashachar in his own cheshbon, he'll have no time to daven, because for alot hashachar, there's no time to daven. That's number one. The second thing Tosafot points out is that even though the pasuk in Nehemiah speaks about the fact that when they were building the Beit HaMikdash, that they used to work from Alot HaShachar until Tzeit HaKochavim, which makes it sound like that the workday was all the way from Alot HaShachar until Tzeit HaKochavim. How come over here we differentiate? Tosafot suggests that that was unique to the Beit HaMikdash, that they did extra because it was work B'Kodesh, but that's not your standard workday. The standard workday is from sunrise until Tzeit HaKochavim, and on the sunrise is when you begin out, and you set out, not at Alot HaShachar. Gemara says, why is Reish Lakish governing what the rules are? Let us look at what the practice is over here. You just said in the Mishnah, everything goes by the normal practices of this area. So why are you giving me governance as to how to do this when you just check what the minhag is and that's it? Be'ir Chadasha. It's a new city. So it's a new city, there is no practice in place. So then what is the practice you should set in place? Here Reish Lakish gives you that guidance. B'nefse meheche ka'atu. Wait a minute. Okay, even though there's no set practice, let's look where they came from. The people who moved to the city derived from another city. The practices in that previous city should govern what the practices are here. That's their minhag. It says, benukotai. It's a case where it's an ingathering of people who come from different sources or locations, and therefore they have different minhagim. So now you have to have some sort of standardized minhag. What is the proper practice? Reish Lakish gives you what the proper practice should be when you're starting out. Ibai Dema, Damra Lahu, Dagrituli Ke Poel Doraita. Now Reish Lakish is trying to address a situation in which the agreement between the parties was, you'll come work for me like a worker of the Torah. So now what is a worker of the Torah? What does that mean? So Reish Lakish comes and defines for you what the workday is according to the Torah. And that is from sunrise when you set out to your work until Tzeit HaKochavim when you finish your work and then only set out to go home. So he was telling us what it is Doraita. It's interesting. Rashi over here says, with regards to the previous statement of the Gemara, that it was a bunch of people got together from different locations, and therefore he says, "V'leka l'mismach el adoraita," and therefore you should have to follow the ways of the Torah, because since there's no set minhag, the Torah should be the governing rule. What's interesting about Rashi is, and the Gemara itself does it over here, it calls it doraita. Doraita usually refers to the Torah itself, yet the proof that we're bringing is from Tehillim, is from Ketuvim. So despite the fact that we're being a pasuk from Tehillim, the Gemara is considering that to be a Torah law, or the Torah governance of what is a workday. It's just interesting to note that, despite the fact that the Gemara brings no pasuk from the Torah. Tarish Rabbi Zera, V'amri la Tani Rabbi Yosef. So Rabbi Zera was Doresh, or some say that a brayta was bought by Rabbi Yosef. Ma dichtiv, what is meant by the pasuk before the pasuk that we just quoted? Tashet choshech v'ilayla. It makes darkness, and then it's night. Bot yirmos Kol chayto yar. At that time, the animals of the forests will stir. Tashet choshech v'ilayla ze olam hazeh. That he makes it dark and it's nighttime. That refers to this world. Shedome l'layla, because it's similar to nighttime. Bo tirmos kol chayto yar elu rishayim shebo. These are the evil people that live bo olam hazeh. Shedomim b'chaya shebiyar. They are similar to the animals of the forest, which is that this is their time to shine. This is their time to live it up, is in Olam Hazeh. Tizrach HaShemesh Yaseifun. So now it continues into our pasuk that we quoted before. When the sun rises, they will gather together. Ve'el me'onotam yirbatsun. And to their plans, they will crouch. But over here, the Gemara is darshaning. We're going to see in a second me'onotam from the word me'ona, which means their location or their dwelling place. Tizrach HaShemesh L'tzadikim. The sun will rise for the tzaddikim. Yesafun rishaim the geinom. The rishaim will then be gathered into geinom. Ve'el min onotam yirbatsun. En lecha kol tzaddik v'tzaddik she'en lo madur lifi kvodo. There is no tzaddik who doesn't get a personal dwelling place or his special place in Olam Haba. In that all individuals are different, unique, and therefore they also have a unique standing in Olam Haba. And so each one will have their particular place when they get to Olam Haba, the tzaddikim. So he darshens the psukim in an allegorical manner to referring to night and day here, referring to Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. The nighttime is the playground of the chayot, but also the playground of the rishayim. And the sun rises, then everything is stilled, everything is left for later, and that's when the tzaddikim rise, which is that's when the rishayim are quieted, and they are now disposed of in Geinom. And that's the time when the tzaddikim rise. It's their opportunity to shine and when they get to go to their dwelling place. Yitzei Adam lepaulo. The person goes out to then do his work. Yitzu tzaddikim lekabel scharam. That's when they will emerge to collect their reward. Ula varato ade arev. And then they will finish or complete their work at nighttime. B'mi shishlim avaroto ade arev. The one who's finished what he was set out to do or that which he was required to do, he will be the one who collects his compensation at nighttime. And just like a poel has to finish the day in order to get paid, meaning that his schirut is paid basof. So when he finishes the whole day's work, that's when he gets paid. So too, the tzaddikim only get paid after they've completed, after everything is done. That's when they get paid back, meaning that the Olam Haba is not a payment during their lifetime. It's only after the completion or the end of their lifetime. In Olam Haba, that is where they will reap the rewards of the work they do if they completed their tasks that they were assigned in Olam Hazeh. Right here we have an interesting story in Agadato that refers to Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon. I'll remind you, Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon is the son of Rabbi Shimon by Yochai. He, based on the Gemara in Shabbat and Daf Lamed Gimel in Shabbat, spent the time with his father in the cave. And the two of them are there and they come out once, they're sent back in and they come back out again. And Rabbi Shimon is a charif, a very sharp character, very similar to his father. And over here we see evidence of that as well, but it's interesting what ends up happening to Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon. The Gemara here discusses it, but the Gemara also in other places discusses this issue in more detail at the death of Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon and the difficulties at the time of his death because of the problems that arise from this story over here, which is that the Chachamim were not so happy with Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon and the profession that he took up. Which is Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon, Ashkach Lahu Paragona, the Katafis Gande. They found this individual, it seems like he was a policeman, some sort of governing official of the king that worked on behalf of the government. And his job was to catch the thieves. He was a crime stopper of sorts. Amalei, Hekiyachotlu. He says, Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon queries him and says, how do you capture the ganavim? How do you know who is a ganav? Because, lav kichayuta mitile. Aren't they compared to the animals? Dichtiv, bo tirmos ko chayto yar. The puzzle that we just quoted, that the rishayim are like animals who walk at night, are in the shadows. They don't come out in the open. How do you know who is a ganav? He says, ikadam rei mahaikra. He proved it to him from this pasuk that they are like animals, meaning that they are hard to capture. Ye'arav b'mistar ki aryeh b'sukah. Lies in wait, just like the lion in his den. So, again, the idea being that it's not easy to catch the ganavim because they work in the shadows. They don't work in the open. And therefore, how do you know that you're capturing ganavim? Dilma shakal tzadike v'shavak trishay. In the end, maybe you're capturing innocent people, and the guilty people you're really not getting. Amalei, Umay Avid, says, what should I do? Harmana de Malkohu. It is the command of the king that I do this. I don't know if he had some sort of quota that he had to fill, But he had to show up with people that were ganavim. So he has no choice but to grab people and turn them in as ganavim. Whether they really are or not ganavim, that's not so important. The king says he wants the thieves off the street. So he's got to do something. So in essence, he seems to be admitting to Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, that he's not certain about the people that he's arresting or whether he's really turning over ganavim. Amar, so Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon says to him, Ta agamrech hechi tavit. I'll teach you the way to do this. Ul ba'arba shay lechanuta. Go in the fourth hour to the store. Over here, it seems the store, either it's the wine store or is the place where people gathered for breakfast. Their day, they only ate two meals a day. One meal was eaten 4 hours into the day, roughly around 10 o'clock. It was a brunch of sorts. And the second meal was eaten when they came home was dinner. That was it. They had two meals a day. So this first meal at Arba Shaot, Kichaze Inish to Kashate Chamra, you see people drinking wine. V'nekanokit Kasebi Yadeh, they're holding the wine cup in their hands. Remember here, wine is not something that we would look at negatively for breakfast because it was one of their staple drinks. It's not a drink here where they're getting drunk. It was a staple product mostly because it was able to preserve itself. And the only things, there was no refrigeration. The only things they could keep for long duration were either things that were dried out, salted, or wine, which stayed for a long period of time. So that was one of the primary drinks that they had at that time. And he's dozing off while he's holding his wine cup. Sha'oli lave. Ask, why is he dozing off at breakfast? Itzur b'mira bonanhu. If he's a young Talmud Chacham, v'naim, and he's dozing off, akdume kodim legirse. That's because he woke up early to chazer over his learning. He got up early to learn, and that's why he is tired. Ipoelhu. If he is a laborer, a day laborer, kodim ka'avid avidite. Got up early to do his work. We saw here that he has to be on the road by sunrise. That means that he got up at the Lota Shachar to prepare and to daven. Via vidite belaila. If his work is at night, redude rudid. Even at night, if his work is at night, then people would know that his work's at night because he makes noise. But he says there are certain professions that you can do at night that don't make noise. And that is the drawing of strings. Now over here, redude rudid, he's described when they built the Mishkan, how do they make strings of zahav? So what Rashi describes over there is that they pounded down the zahav until it was extremely thin, and then they used to pull or peel the strings off of that very thin gold. That's how you get gold strings. So redude radid means to pound down or to flatten out. And so what he's saying is that even though you didn't hear him with the hammer, because that's how you make them at first, you could have been that he was pulling the strings. And the way that you do is you pull it through holes that successively get smaller and smaller. So they slowly make the item into a thread instead of a thicker item. So he could be doing this work at night, but he's silent. But if he works at night, it's obvious why he's tired here in the morning. Vilo, if he's none of the above, then Ganvo, he's a thief. Betafse, and you should arrest him because he works at night. Ganavim are out at night. They are marauding or they are lying in wait, ambushing people at night, trying to steal from them. But their work is at night. And therefore, they're tired in the morning because they just finished a day's work for them, which is their night. Ishtama milta be'malko. The Caesar, the king, got word of his suggestion. Amru, they use this expression. Kraino di grata il have parvanka. The one who reads the decree should be the one who carries it out. The Midrash has the same expression by Pinchas. When Pinchas says to Moshe Rabbeinu, didn't you teach us that boel aramit kanaim pogimbo? So Moshe says back to Pinchas, kraina di grata iulavi parvanka. The one who reads the letter or the decree should be the one who carries it out. So over there, Pinchas, you're the one who remembered halacha, you should act on it. So the same thing over here. You, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, are the one providing the advice. You go ahead and take care of it. You actually become the policeman. So this was Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon's new profession now. He was a shoter, he became a policeman, capturing these thieves. Atzua, the Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, v'tatofis ganve. They pressed him into service, basically, and said, he has to now be it. And that was his job now. He was the thief catcher. It's especially ironic that Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, is cooperating with the government, given the fact that he and his father actually ended up in the cave together because they were persecuted by the government. And so therefore, it's even more ironic that Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon is involved in this type of practice or in this job. Vazil shalach le Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, chometz ben Yayin. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha went ahead and sent to him Chometz ben Yayin, the one who is a vinegar, the son of wine. The indication wine was his father, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Chometz is wine gone bad. So you, Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon, are gone bad. Ad matay ata moser amo shel Elokeinu lahariga. How could it be that you're giving over people to the king, to the Caesar, and they're killing them? I mean, that the penalty for this type of behavior was death penalty. So how is it that you're turning over Jews to the government and they're killing them? Shalach lei kotzim ani michalei min hakerem. He says, I'm weeding out the thorns from the vineyard. I'm not turning over good people, I'm turning over the thorns. His hint also might be that the thorns or the bad growth in the kerem make it into vinegar. So he was playing on the vinegar that Rabbi Shimon Karcha had called him. He said, it's vinegar because we have these bad people around. But if they weren't bad people, I'd have nobody to turn over. Shalach lei. So Rabbi Shimon ben Karcha says back to him, Yavo bala kerem v'yichalet kutzav. Let the owner of the vineyard come and take out the thorns himself. Meaning, he's saying, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, let HaKadosh Baruch Hu take care of it. Why are you intervening? And based on what's called the Mashala Kerem in the Navi Yirmiyahu, who speaks about the fact that we compare Bnei Israel to a vineyard and Hashem as the master of the vineyard. So over here, based on that, he should be the one clearing out the kotzim or the kilayim in the kerem, but you shouldn't be involved. Nevertheless, Rabbi Shimon Elazar continues with his work, and that's what I said before, this leads to a wedge between Rabbi Shimon Elazar and the other chachamim, and at the time of his death, it presents a very big difficulty because they didn't come to properly honor him or to bury him, and it leads to a whole story surrounding his death where he actually doesn't get buried for many years. Right? Yom Echad, Pagavu HaKoves. One day he bumped into this launderer, Karya Chometz ben Yayin. He looks to Rabbi Shimon Elazar and calls him vinegar, the son of wine. Amar midechatzev kulihai. Since this guy is so mechutzav. Now, what the mechutzav here is not clear. Is it because he's a launderer calling Rabbi Shimon Elazar Chometz ben Yayin? Or is the mechutzav over here is that he said it to his face? Rabbi Shimon Karcha sent a message to Rabbi Shimon Elazar that you are Chometz ben Yayin. This koveis went ahead and said it face to face to Rabbi Shimon Elazar. So the chutzpah is either he said it to his face, or the chutzpah is that he's a koveis and not Rabbi Shimon ben Karcha, and why is he calling Rabbi Shimon Elazar Chometz ben Yayin? Shmami na rishiyahu. Anybody that mechutzav is definitely a rasha. I'm a little tafsu. So he tells the government officials, take him away. Tafsua, they grabbed him and took him off. The bater de nachdate. After he was assuaged from his anger, now, this is classic. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. We have stories there, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, many stories throughout Shas, that if you got on the wrong side of Rabbi Shimon Yochai, you ended up as a pile of bones on the floor. And we also know from their exiting of the cave that everywhere they looked got burnt up. And that's why Hashem sent them back in. But even the second time when they emerged, it says that everywhere Rabbi Shimon Elazar looked burnt up. And where Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai looked at it, then it was cured or restored. So Rabbi Shimon Elazar remains a very easily angered individual, and you don't want to be there when he is upset. And that's what happened here. He got upset at this individual and had him taken away by the authorities. So after he calmed down, Azal Batre Lefruke, he went to follow up with him and get him released. Velo Matzi, he couldn't find him. Kari Ale, whether he said this about that individual or about himself, Shomer Piv Ulushono, Shomer Mitzarat Nafsho. Person who watches his mouth, and that what he says protects himself from a lot of problems. So either he was saying that about himself because he got angry and he said grab him, so he caused himself the problem. Or he was saying about this guy. This guy who opened his mouth, Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon, ended up getting taken away by the authorities because he didn't watch what he said. Zakfua. They hung him. They killed him. Kam tutez kifa v'kabochi. Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon stood under the place where they had hanged him. And he was crying, he was bawling about the fact that he was responsible for this individual's death. Even all that he had done was that he was mechutzav. That wasn't subject to a death penalty. Amrulei Rabbi, ayirei abeinecha. So there were some people who passed by and said to him, don't worry about it. Shubno balu naramu rasa b'yom ha-kippurim. He and his son had an affair with a woman who was halachically engaged on Yom Kippur. Now, I'm not sure whether they mean this in an exact manner, and this is really the violation, or this is a way that the Gemara uses in other places as well to express someone who's a wanton violator. Meaning here, on Yom Kippur, which is the holiest day of the year, when the Satan is even not to be katreig, so that's a day where you get a break from it, so maybe how could it be that you're sinning on Yom Kippur? On top of that, it's with the Nara Murasa, which is the most severe of punishments. And a Nara Murasa is subject to Skila. And we go, Kol HaNiskalim Nitlin. Anybody who is subject to Skila gets hanged afterwards. And therefore, this was the appropriate punishment for this individual. And so therefore, you should be okay, or you should be placated, because it was justified, his death over here. So either it was literally that he violated this, and therefore he was deserving of this particular death, or this is a way to express that this person was a wanton violator of halacha and was deserving of the death penalty, so you shouldn't be so guilty, feel so guilty about it. He placed his hands on his stomach. The reason is, he's extremely heavy. He is fat. Amar Sisu b'nei me'ai. Sisu says, you should celebrate, you should be happy, my innards. Masvei kochel lechem kach. Here where you were uncertain about whether I did the right thing, it turns out I was 100% right. When I know that these people are problematic and they are ganavim, then certainly I am justified in my behavior and my actions. So here, Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon indicates that he believes that he's justified and that he's right in what he's doing. The problem is, why is he right in what he's doing? How is it he's allowed to hand over these people to the king, who in the end is killing them, which is not the halachic outcome for a ganav. It's not the proper punishment. So what you have to argue here is that it's dina de machuta dina, and as long as the government enforces it on a consistent basis, then it's a din and not an exception to the rule, and therefore you can be a party to it because you're just acting on behalf of the government, who has a right to set the laws in place. And this is the law of the land, and you have to follow the law of the land accordingly. So now he says, Muftach ani bachem, she'ein rima betoleya sholetet bachem. I am certain that no rot or decomposition will affect you, meaning that when he passes away, his body will remain whole. That is the siman that we know that tzaddikim don't decompose, their bodies remain whole after death. So he's saying, despite the fact that he was extremely overweight, in fact, the Gemara tomorrow will discuss how big he was, but given that, he says that, I don't think that any of this fat will rot when I die. And again, the stories in the Gemara besides this, but we not have here, but other stories discuss the fact that after he passed away, his body remained intact for years, despite the fact that they did not bury him. Even after that whole speech, he still was not placated, and he was worried about the fact that was he really right about what happened to this individual, this koves, as well as the behaviors here where he's handing people over to the government. Ashkua sama de shinto. They gave him, we'll call it a potion of sleep, but it's an anesthetic. They gave him an anesthetic, they put him to sleep. Vayalua the beta de shisha. They brought him into a house of marble, which was the equivalent of their operating room in that day. Vikaru de krese. They opened up his stomach. Vabu mafko mine dikule dikule de tarba. And baskets of fat were coming out. I mean, he was so overweight and he was so fat that this fat was oozing out of his body after they cut him. And they put the fat out in the sun during the heat of the summer, Tammuz Av, which is the hottest time of the year, and it did not go bad, it did not rot. Mar says, Kol tarbe nami lo sariach. No fat goes bad. When you leave fat in the heat, it doesn't go bad. Kol tarbe lo sariach, siruke sumke masriach. You're right. Fat in general does not go bad. But when fat has blood mixed in with it, or basar, or flesh mixed in with it, then it does go bad, meaning that it has to be the organic material, which is either the flesh or the blood, that's what goes bad when it's mixed together with the fat. And over here, hacha, afagav deika siruke sumke, even though there were streaks of red, meaning blood or basar there, lo masriach, it did not go bad. Kari anafshe, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon said about himself, Af bisari yishkon levetach. My flesh will be at ease or safe forever. In that he felt about himself that whether he did this intentionally to test himself and to say that the fat that he had gathered around his belly was not because he was being punished somehow and it was a problem, but rather it was a sign that he was healthy and that there was nothing wrong. And that's why he did this test, to show that he was a person of integrity and that Hashem was happy with him, and therefore his body didn't rot, that he was really a tzaddik. V'af Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yosei, mata ki hai maisi liyodei. Rabbi Shmuel b'Rabbi Yosei was also pressed into service in a similar manner to Rabbi Elazar b'Rabbi Shimon. Paga be Eliyahu. Eliyahu Navi bumps into Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi. Amarle and Matayat Omosera Moshel Alukeno Lariga. How long are you going to be involved in this business where you're turning over Jews to the government to be killed? Amarle Ma'avid. Harmana de Malku. What can I do? It's the command of the king. I am following the Dina de Malchuta Dina. What should I do? Amarle Avuch Arak La'Asia. Your father ran away to Asia to escape the ire of the government. Ataruklu Ludkia. You should run away to Ludkia, meaning that you should escape having to do this by running away from the government's hand. Going to a place where they don't have authority, a place that's outside the realm of their empire, and then you'll be safe. So you should run away. Again, here, the fact that Eliyahu tells this to Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yossi, is also a quasi-indictment of Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, who should have run away or left. So it seems that Eliyahu is not necessarily questioning the right of him to be involved, or whether it was right or wrong. He's simply saying, why are you the person who is the shliach to carry this out? Let Hashem take care of it. You shouldn't be the one who gets these people in trouble, even though they might be justified or might be right that they get into trouble. Ki avo mikle Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon ade adodi. When Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Shimon used to walk together, or may let's say they got face to face, hava ayo bakra de tore beinayu v'lo anava gnagabahu. A pair of oxen were able to walk under their bellies without touching them. So if they stood stomach to stomach, they were so large that they basically created a bridge. Their two stomachs created a bridge that the oxen were able to walk under them. Amaru hayu motronita, a matron, which is a status within Rome, which were usually women of high stature within the government. They had tremendous wealth as well as sway, political sway within the government. You see that many times in the Gemara that the Chachamim are petitioning a matronita to argue on behalf of the Jews or to get something from the government. So this matronita, and sometimes again they also had enough sway that they could force men to come and spend time with them. We also saw stories like that also in the Gemara. B'neichem einam shelachem. She said to Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, your children are not your own children. Because of the fact that you are so overweight, there's no way that you can engage in Piriya Rivya because of your overweight. So Amrula shelahen gadol mishalanu. So they answered back to the woman, our wives are even bigger than we are. They're even fatter or larger than we are. Gemara says, koshekein. Wait a minute. Then you're in a bigger problem. If their wives are just as big as they are, then the likelihood that they're able to engage in Piriya Rivya is very low. Because they both have the same problem, which is they're not able to get together. Ikadamre, hachu amrula. So some say they responded like this to her. Kegeish gevurato. That the member of an individual is commensurate to the size of the individual. And so that overcomes the problem. Ikadamre, hachi amrula. Some suggest that this is what they answered her. Ahava dochechet et abasar. That love can overcome the fat or the distance between us. Valamalaula durela. Why do they have to respond to her at all? This is some machonita making a claim to them. Why do they have to respond at all? Vachtiv, doesn't the posuk say, Altaan ksil b'ki'ivalto. Do not answer the fool like his foolishness. Or should not answer the fool with his perverseness. Shelo lo tzi laz al b'neim. The answer is that they didn't want to cast aspersion on their children. Her claim would be heard by others, and then others would suspect whether their children are really their own children. And so therefore they had to give an answer to justify why their children were really their children, so as not to cast aspersions on the parenthood of their children, so that they would not be considered to be mamzerim. We're going to stop here, 13 lines down on Pei Daled Amud Aleph, and continue with this Agadah tomorrow.